This is the Ask Us Anything panel. So, okay, we're done.
Well, you know, actually, someone, I've forgotten who it was, I asked you to remind me to talk about something, and I don't know who it was or what it was. Oh, several hands go up.
All right, yeah. I think the first was the gentleman back.
Okay, then we'll go to you, Alec. The question is, you're in an environment where you're not Unicode, standard exception, it is Unicode, standard exception is not Unicode. What gives? Well, the standard was created a long time ago. Has supported wide characters ever since, but so you've got string and you've got W string, for example, but everybody by convention has been using string because, you know, since whenever. Java came along later and could start with Unicode right out of the gate, C sharp as well. But there is support for it, W string, WCHART, it's been there for some time. It's supported on compilers, including ours, GCC, all the major compilers. But yes, exceptions like to traffic in string without the W. If the question is, what about extending that to use W string? I haven't heard people talking about it, but it's certainly something that we ought to start thinking about. Do you guys have an opinion?
My answer is, it just turns out I inadvertently and totally not out of my own volition, it became sort of a Unicode connoisseur. It just so happens that char star is perfectly adequate for representing Unicode strings in the UTF-8 encoding. Which is, I consider UTF-8 the best encoding there is, and I would actually actively recommend against using WCHAR as the UTF-16 encoding element in strings. UTF-16 is a disaster because, I'm exaggerating, UTF-16 is pretty bad because pretty much everybody believes there is one character per code unit, which is not the case. There are the so-called surrogate characters, which means, oh, whenever this character in this particular range occurs, just a second, whenever this particular character range occurs as the first character, oh, look at the second character, and the pair of the two white characters form one actual unit. And most people don't even know that. They assume that WCHART is Unicode and char is not Unicode. Allow me to disabuse you all of this mistake, because it's not the case. UTF-8 is the best encoding there is. It's absolute genius. It's a very good encoding. UTF-16 is an inferior encoding. And UTF-32 is a plain, each character would be a 32-bit unit. That's very wasteful. So that kind of goes away. To answer your question directly, I think char star does not in any way prevent you from using Unicode properly. On the contrary, it actually promotes good understanding and good knowledge and good using of this particular encoding, UTF-8, which is very good.
How does the standardization committee work?
Does it work?
Well, first of all, drop the how.
I can answer that.
Yeah. Well, we actually have several people here who have attended some meetings, and others of you who've already approached me about how to attend. So please send me an email if you're interested in coming. The meetings are open to the public. Next one's next week in Bloomington, Indiana, so it may be kind of short to get there, but hey, if you want to show up, you can. The Standardization Committee basically works. There's a U.S. committee and an international committee that meet together. It's not that the U.S. is special, it's just it's the biggest, and so it's convenient to have them meet together. But basically, every nation has its own panel. The U.S.'s panel meetings just happen to coincide. And so within the U.S., if you're a member there, it's one company, one vote, as we go through and work on pieces of the standard. At the ISO level, it's one nation, one vote. How does it work? It works based on proposals. People come up with proposals. They get support for them. They go through many meetings to successively refine them, incorporate feedback, come back some more, show prototype implementations, tweak them again. So it's typically a year or two commitment to get a proposal through. So please don't just send us a proposal for a great idea and think anything's going to happen, because you need to do the work. Usually they're not nearly detailed enough, and you need to be able to do the work to progress it to the point where millions of people might use it. But those kinds of things are certainly welcome, and we'll soon look at the next round of standardization after C++OX details to be firmed up. Okay, so the short version of this, shared pointers passed by value, because we talked this morning about how to pass them, or yesterday morning, to pass them by reference and why. This conversation started because Alex approached me saying, well, how come the Visual C++ implementation of shared pointer goes through all these layers of function indirections, whereas the Boost shared pointer, you know, there's like one function call or none, and it looks like it's so slow, because I've looked at the disassembly, and the first thing I said we've optimized that since then, but is my intuition wouldn't be too worried about the code path length, because the big overhead usually is on the increment decrement of the reference count. Could you please do some experiments? And you came back with?
Less than 10%
difference, because the bulk of the operation, doesn't matter whether you had 100 instructions or two, the expensive one was the atomic increment-decrement, even on x86, where it's not too bad. So it's really important when you pass shared putters, copies are expensive. The expense is not in usually any of the rest of the implementation. Dollars to donuts, it's your reference count, increment-decrement. That's what you save by passing by reference. But look again at those slides. They'll be in your PDFs post-event that say, here are the two pitfalls and how to avoid them or mitigate them when you pass shared putters by reference. And that applies to any reference counter pointer.
Yes. Let me make one comment here, because since it's come up a couple of times. There's nothing special about shared pointer when it comes to whether you pass it by value or you pass it by reference. You use exactly the same analysis you use for any other user-defined type. It's just that people seem to have this perception that shared pointer somehow solves all management problems, and that because it's small, it's necessarily inexpensive to pass by value. It has to be copied, unless you can move optimize it, but it has to be copied, and there is a cost associated with that. So the question is, do you want to pass it by reference or do you want to pass it by value? It's exactly the same question you'd ask if you were passing anything else by value. Sometimes people worry about, well, okay, let's suppose I pass a shared pointer in, and then while something's happening there, somebody else changes it. Well, you can't have that happen unless there's multi-threading going on, because you just called some function synchronously. The called function has the shared pointer. So if something is going to change it outside of program control, there's got to be another thread. And if you now have an object being referenced by two threads simultaneously without synchronization, you have a race condition which you need to resolve. So it has nothing to do with shared pointer. It's the same analysis. And that's also why, because of the same analysis, it makes perfect sense to say it's expensive to pass it by value. So if I can get away with it with proper semantics in my program, I'm going to pass it by reference to const or reference instead.
Let me just add to that, to emphasize again, shared putters always pass them by reference to const. And very occasionally, maybe because you know that what you call might modify the thing that you got a reference from, maybe then you might pass by value. But when people use shared putter in their code, people asked, what are some of the big pitfalls going to C++OX? Well, this was in TR1 as well, but it's part of C++OX. The reference counter pointers have got a bad name for performance. Even Bjarne hesitates to recommend them because of their overhead. In my experience, virtually all of the complaints come from people passing them as parameters, because you do that way more often than you copy them for other reasons. And if you copy them as parameters, oh my goodness, you almost never need to bump that reference count, because it's being held alive anyway. And you should be passing it by reference. So please do that. Otherwise, you will probably get pushback on using it when it's a good thing. Just use it correctly the fast way.
To summarize, I think a good mnemonic for it all, worrying about pass by value versus reference of shared pointer from a correctness standpoint, as was pointed, I think that the reality is shared pointer is actually pointer to shared, so the pointer itself is never shared.
Yes.
It's not meant to be shared. The data, the pointee, is shared. So shared pointer is really a sort of a misnomer. In reality, it's pointer to shared. Just the same way we say it's a template function, it's actually a function template, you know, stuff like that.
Hey, wait a minute.
So there's a question.
The C++OX final international ballot ends today. Is there still time to change shared putter to putter shared?
Probably not. Yes, there's a long time. There's a question here.
Is it worth repeating? I mean, the comment simply is that if you have a shared pointer to const, you have a shared pointer to, say, a const widget, and for some reason you're going to turn that into a shared pointer to a widget, even if they point to the same object. They're different shared pointer types, so you are going to get a different cut. You are going to get a new object being created.
There is a allocation.
You got to deep copy down because you can't.
So the point is, you're going to create a brand new shared pointer, which will cause a brand new reference count to be created.
And the new brand new widget, I assume.
No, just the reference count.
All right.
Shared pointer, you lost cost or you lost performance. The best is not to use.
I don't. So the question is, you with shared Twitter, the assertion was you either lose cost or you lose performance, and it's best not to just not to use it. I think that's a little harsh. Maybe in your environment, always measure first, but I think that's a little harsh. It's interesting if it didn't get. I don't remember whether the standard supports the conversion from the shared Twitter of widget to shared Twitter of const widget. We should, and there's nothing preventing adding that if we didn't provide that. We do? I thought we did. Okay, thank you. So there shouldn't be an additional reference count allocation and double reference counting going on. If there is, compiler vendors can optimize that anyway, but I don't think that's one of the problems. You also get drive-to-base conversions and all of those things.
No, I misspoke. You shouldn't get another reference count.
Okay.
It does create a new shared pointer part, but not a.
Because I think it's the same mechanics that give you the drive-to-base conversion.
Yeah, it is exactly the same
mechanics. The non-const to const conversion.
Trivial. Yeah. Go ahead.
So the observation was, you hear, a shared pointer is thread safe, and then people think that they don't have to synchronize them. That's not true. In fact, all you have to remember is it's just like any other object. If more than one thread can see that shared pointer, including if you're copying from it, for example, better put a lock around it or do whatever your normal synchronization is. The only reason it uses interlocked operations under the covers is because it's doing even more sharing under the covers, so it's got to do some internal synchronization just to get you back to the level where you can do the normal external synchronization so you can't tell the difference, that's all. Yeah, but don't think that the shared pointer is just like any other object. Synchronize it if it's shared. Homework. Any non-shared putter questions?
Wait. Homework assignment. Go into the standard and find out where it guarantees the manipulation of that hidden reference count is going to take place.
All right.
Hint, it never mentions the reference count.
A non-shared pointer question.
So the question is, what kind of work do we do with or outside our companies, since we also work for companies? There's a lot of overlap. Like, I'll go first briefly, and then, because you're also in this boat. You asked the standards committee. So Microsoft contributes my time, sends me to the standards committee, sponsors me as the convener to chair the standards committee, which involves not just going and being there 2-3 weeks of the year, but also all the administrivia in between as a tax on time. It's not too bad, but it's non-trivial. And so Microsoft sponsors that as part of my day job. I'm not the only Microsoft person who goes to standards committee meetings. There's usually at least one other one as well, because you can't be in all the subgroups at the same time. And as far as doing other things like this event, there's a great overlap between the work I do in that job versus being here and telling about things I found out about using C++, and also hearing. This is a great opportunity for me to hear from A, customers, and B, future customers. So, and non-customers, that's all great. And just, stay in sync with what's going on internally and externally. It's very beneficial for me that way. And I'm assuming that you're probably finding some of those same things.
Some are so lucky. I'm not nowhere near that situation. At Facebook, so there's two issues, the sort of legal permission issue and the, time and money issue, so to speak. At Facebook, the policy on sharing knowledge is pretty simple. Essentially, everything that's not core business is okay. For example, Facebook simply open sourced a lot of its non-essential components, very generously, I would say, because they did entail a lot of work, and there are very large products and very very powerful and very good products, and they just made them available to the community. Of course, the community responded in kind and added value to those products. Other than that, I'm on my own time here. I do everything C++ on my own time. Facebook is happy to have me as the resident C++ expert, but my job title is a research scientist, and I do machine learning at Facebook. I don't do C++. So, in essence, again, Herb is much luckier than I am. So here, for example, I'm on vacation officially from Facebook.
And same with me. I'm here on vacation.
Personal time. Yeah. All right, so here comes the luckiest guy in the world.
Are you here on vacation, Scott? We are.
I work for me. I don't get vacation. So.
What you gonna do?
Yeah. All right.
But you do C++ 24/7, 365.
I have a website. So I work for me, so I get to do whatever I want. And it turns out that one of the things that I want to do is events like this from time to time, so that's kind of what I do. So I don't have the same issues that you guys do, so I don't have to worry about, for example, healthcare or salary or, any of that kind of stuff.
Fair enough.
was there.
So what's 24/7, 365? Would that be like 7 years?
No, that's like.
I either say 24/7 or, you know,
7 years.
It's gonna be 7 years.
Yes. That's right.
Just pointing, just destroying. Yes. Question.
The question is atomic, the implementations of the atomic template and which ones are lock-free on Visual Studio. It's less about Visual Studio as in on target architecture. And so we support x86 and now ARM, as well as there has been support for Itanium, x64. So basically go by what the hardware allows you to do. We'll map straight to those instructions. If not, for larger things like atomic of big struct, which is perfectly allowed, then you create a spin lock or something efficient under the covers. So it's more about the target architecture. I bet you the list would be exactly the same for a GCC implementation as for ours. That'd be my guess. Oh, so the question is the is lock free on atomics is for the whole class. Some operations might be and some might not be. I can't imagine how that could be because you've got to synchronize it somehow. Some architectures may support increment but not CAS, but the problem is everybody has to, if you're sharing a piece of data just in general, the entire system better agree to how we're protecting it. If we're protecting it with a mutex, all the threads in the system that touch that data at that time have to agree, okay, we're going to take the mutex and let go. You can't have some threads saying, I'll do an atomic operate, and some threads taking a mutex. Sometimes you can finesse that a little bit, but in general, it's not quite as easy as that. Sometimes you can optimize it and they can't tell, but not always.
I think maybe the motivation for the question is it turns out that is lock free can return yes, no, or maybe. Mm-hmm.
But typically aligned 32 and 64-bit quantities on most common platforms these days. And beyond that, you're likely to not be lock free.
Oh, actually, on Intel, what's happening right now on Intel 64, there is a double word CAS that allows you to do 128-bit CAS. In theory, it's not supported by all Intel-like varieties. I seem to recall there's an older AMD processor that was 64-bit but didn't support double word CAS. I think that can be safely ignored. my belief is for the future that you can count on double word. Structures up to double word width are going to be virtually lock free. This is my understanding from the current state of affairs and the way things are moving forward. Double word is going to become common.
The kind of stuff that I was talking about officially is the memory consistency model. Because it's only trying to answer one question, which is if you do a read, what are you going to find? That is the one question it's supposed to answer. So it's the memory consistency model.
And memory model is an overloaded term because then people who are thinking objects think about object lifetimes. People who are too old to still be working, like me, will be thinking about small, medium, large, compact. If you come from a bad part of town.
If I may add a brief anecdote, actually there is a story behind this. Memory model, people didn't realize for 40 years that you need to have a memory consistency model for software. The term comes from hardware, where memory model is an essential component of, you know, what's going to happen on the bus, on the address and data bus, whenever you have multiple accesses to it. And that's, they don't need to say memory consistency model because it's absolutely implied because they don't have objects and virtual functions and stuff, right? They don't have object layout to worry about. So for hardware people, it's memory model. And it took us as a community, it took us like 40 years to realize, and the first people who realized were, Java, Doug Lee, who was working on Java for a long time already, and Pugh, what's his name?
Ken Pugh.
So there are people who discovered essentially it was like the DCLP's broken statement. They figured out a number of things, and all of a sudden it dawned on us as a community in the software that we need to define a memory model just like in hardware for programs, which was a sort of a foreign concept in the beginning, back in 2001 when it first started. And that's why people interchangeably use memory model and memory consistency model, because it comes from hardware where the consistency word objective is implied.
It's interesting to see the history, though, because when only hardware people needed to know about it and didn't know much about its impact on software, it was like the Wild West square. Like, they were all over the place. And Andre gave a very nice talk, which got me interested in memory models, so it's your fault, talking about how, who proved that half the architectures in the world didn't work.
I'm
spacing on the name.
A French name. right?
Yeah, we'll think about it. So everybody was going along nicely, shipping billions and billions of computers, and then a guy wrote, whose name is very famous and it will come to us immediately, wrote a paper, Maurice Herlihy. Wrote a paper, was it 93, basically pointing out that half of them weren't sufficient.
And one that was in the works by IBM, he proved it doesn't work, the project was canceled.
Right. Yes.
It's kind of funny.
And he proved the half. So then suddenly from the wild, wild west squared, you went down to the wild, wild west. So it's still pretty all over the map. Over that time, DEC Alpha, PowerPC, many others have tried all sorts of different exotic. Sun decided one memory model wasn't enough. Let's have seven or so of them. And they overlap and are variously documented. And as we, in the last decade, starting with JSR 133, the Java memory model, if I've got the number right, followed by ISO C++, followed by others, the industry is now coalescing around sequential consistency in race-free programs, data race-free programs. And we have only a couple, as we were saying earlier today, we have only a couple of architectures left. PowerPC and ARM are the two popular ones that still are weak consistency, where it's expensive to have sequential consistency. Everybody else has really moved to strong memory models, and my own personal belief is that's exactly what we'll see happen in the next small number of years. Weak memory models will go away. Either architectures will abandon them or stick with them and the architectures will disappear, because the industry is lining up around SC. So the question is, isn't the flexible memory model of the ARM architecture
relaxed,
what gives you
relaxed,
gives you lower power, gives you throughput. I know, that was the argument for Alpha, which is gone. That was the argument for PowerPC, which is, well, anyway. And ARM is doing well. Now, the answer is, and I've said this to some of you in hallway discussions, in one sentence, let's see if it can be a sentence without semicolons. If you have a relaxed memory model where things can be all over the place until you sync, you get better performance until you sync, but the problem is you still have to sync, and those syncs are way more expensive, so that when you do the sync, you sync not only enough to get sequential consistency, but you turn off a slew of other important optimizations, which you end up net slower. It is better to target the hardware for the right thing, the sequentially consistent data race free model, which modern architectures are more and more doing directly, rather than try to target something looser and make it good, and then you end up overshooting and being slower in the end and doing more work in the end. That's where ARM and PowerPC are today, and x86 and AMD, those kinds of ones are more in targeting SC more closely. So he wants to know what our favorite features are, because clearly you said yours was, let's see if I can say this right, variadic templates. Did I do that with the right pauses?
You're awesome.
You're scary. You're the guy who inflicted widespread use of template parameters on the world, and now it's, well, I can't say it twice. So you say it again.
Gotta do it again, yeah. Go ahead. Tell. What?
Why do you like variadic template variadic? No, I got that inverted.
VVTT.
Why do you like them?
It was an exaggeration. I think it's an interesting point in design space. That's pretty much all.
Don't be all
very high level abstraction. And I wouldn't say they're my top favorite. I think just sheer variadic templates are, better. Essentially, VVTTs sort of get almost there, but because there's no aliasing via type, that they really fall short. I don't think there's a lot of forethought in the core language for accommodating this particular abstraction. Go ahead. I don't want to bloat myself, Scott.
Yeah, I'm a simple guy, so I like auto.
Auto.
I think auto is really sweet, and I think that I think on a day-to-day basis, when you're just writing code, that is the one thing that just eliminates a whole bunch of friction that was there before. So I really like auto. And then, sort of stepping back a little more broadly, I'm very pleased that they actually have support for threading, which is one word but includes the memory consistency model, includes the entire threading API. I think that's also a really nice thing for programmers to finally have available. So those are probably the two that come to mind.
I pick auto, standardized smart pointers, and
threading,
atomics. But I got to say, and Lambdas is coming out of my mouth.
I knew you were going to say Lambdas.
Because it makes STL itself, just single threaded, nothing else, makes STL algorithms 10 to 100x more usable. And it is a game changer for parallel algorithms. It just makes it much easier to deal with at that level. Yeah. So it's really convenient.
Yeah, Lambdas are cool. They're great.
It's the invasion of the functional languages.
They could be greater.
They will be. They will be. Oh. The question, I think, is about what's next for the standards committee.
Ask what we as a group want next.
Oh, I was taking a poll for how many, it was interesting, so I took a poll for how many of you, let me retake the poll, because I don't think it was clear I was talking about language extensions. Clearly, I think everybody and their kid brother and their dog and maybe cat agrees that we ought to do more library extensions. It's sorely needed. In terms of language extensions, the compilers are still going to catch up to C++ OX. So, quick show of hands, options are don't immediately continue innovating. Don't stop. Give us, make up more new features and don't wait for the compilers to catch up. Second is, wait for please at least a year and let the compilers catch up and the standard stabilize a bit so we can start using it, and then please add my favorite feature to the language, versus, no, please wait 3 or more years. So how many of you would like us to just keep right on innovating in the standard with language extensions even before compiler vendors catch up? Wow, that's more than last time. Versus. How many wait at least a year?
All right.
Oh, okay. So maybe a tiny bit more and wait 3 or more years? A few. Yeah. Oh, you're going to be nice to us now. So you don't want us to burn out. Like, it's been a decade, man, Lior. So it looks like it's roughly evenly split between keep right on going to, you know, wait a year and a bit, but don't wait too long. So that's interesting information. We're on camera, so I will make sure the C++ committee sees this.
Yeah, so what are the advantages? So he started by making a comment that in his organization, templates are shunned, right? And he said, you know, what ammunition are you going to give me to go back to my organization and say, hey, you know, I know you hate templates, but this time around, you know, they did their homework much better, right? So, you know, what is the increased power and convenience of templates in C++ 2011?
In particular, you were doing type lists and tuples, or tuples, depending on your accent. I'm with you on tuples. I sometimes slip. And also, but code bloat and temp compilation time, yuck. And how can we get that to adopt people to adopt it now? What does the standard do? The new standard has tuples in the library. Won't do much about the rest of, they've had some extensions to templates, but templates are pretty much as they have been with extensions, so those are more compiler quality issues. When we get concepts in the future, perhaps, that might change that equation a little bit.
Just a brief answer. My belief is that with Variadix now in place, essentially, typelists have always been a sort of a Cinderella. Kind of, you know, everybody's like, typelists is the one C++ trick that everybody wishes they know and nobody else does, sort of thing. So with this, I believe there's going to be a lot of legitimization of typelists, because now they're very easy to define and use. And for that reason, I believe that both compilers are going to pay more attention to optimal implementations thereof, and also I believe that people are going to cast a more favorable eye on them. So I think Variadix templates are going to increase acceptance of advanced template techniques.
Just out of, are you concerned primarily about templates in general or template metaprogramming, more advanced template techniques?
I'm talking about in general. Anyone, like in an organization, if you start saying something about templates, they'll say no.
Template keyword is still there.
Yeah. I'll just make one comment actually about templates, just because it's a little different with C++ OX. You can't do perfect forwarding without templates, and perfect forwarding is an enabling technology for move semantics. So to the extent that move semantics allows you to replace expensive copies with less expensive moves, that dovetails into forwarding, and you can't do forwarding without templates.
Very good argument.
So there's sort of an argument to be made there for efficiency.
Awesome. So he gave you one cannonball. You were asking for ammunition. There's one.
There it is. Good question.
What's our favorite feature that isn't in the standard, but could be?
The only feature that couldn't.
Polymorphic lambdas.
Okay, I'll agree with that for
you
now, until I think of a better one.
Static if. I think static if is a major loss in the expressiveness of the language. And the fact that we still have to rely on enable if, which is, at the end of the day, is you know, is not a very palatable thing for many people. I presume, for example, in organizations, when they see enable if, they don't know what to eat it with, right? So static if would have meant a world of difference in the usefulness and usability of advanced templates.
By the way, I agree. Enable if is like this horrid thing you stick on the return type just to knock the compiler over the head and make it do the right thing. Why wouldn't someone, especially you who love them, hide it behind a macro?
Enable if is just one of the many palliatives you need to use for the lack of static if, because with static if you could actually enable or disable entire portions of classes and functions statically. So sort of a pound, when I say static if, I mean pound if on steroids integrated within the language. That's what I mean. So static if would enable it to, for example, define a lot of the functions we discussed this morning, like get and that explosion and everything, would allow them to define in one shot with static if, almost as good and as expressive and as simple as a regular if, you can't currently.
How do you know that if we had that it would actually work, that it would be as expressive and simple as a regular if?
I just know.
Come on, Andre, say why you know.
We discussed this in private. So we have this experience with static if in the deep programming language where it's been extremely compelling. I'm loath of mentioning D because this is not the time and place. So
this is C++ and beyond, man.
And beyond. This is the beyond part. The question was, what is the deal with systematic and principled thread termination at program termination? Is that correct? Thank you. So, in essence, the simple arithmetic of it is that threads are easy to start, difficult to synchronize, and next to impossible to stop. Right? No, this is the reality. So this is the way the model works. Most threading systems do have a kill thread primitive. And without exception, all systems say, do not use it under penalty of death, okay?
Undefined
of
behavior.
Death of the thread. Under the penalty of undefined behavior. Because when you forcefully kill a thread, what's going to happen is that its stack is just going to go away. No destructors called. It could be holding a lock or whatnot. It could be holding a client-level lock, which is difficult to, the system doesn't know how to unlock it. Right. If it holds a kernel mutex, that's fine because the system knows, okay, I can unlock this mutex forcefully. But if it's a client-level mutex, they don't know what to do. Right. No destructors called. It could be writing a file at the very point. It's absolutely crazy. So, you don't want to. Hence the question. How do we? I discussed this with Hans Bohm back in the day. And, we discussed and we agreed that, there's got to be a protocol for thread termination, at application termination. And it just so turns out that the thread standardization process has been difficult and slow that essentially this particular protocol and issue remained unresolved. And it looks very good as a TR2 candidate, having such a protocol for termination.
So I used to think that.
Not anymore.
And because it's true, basically for political reasons that are gory and of sausage-making variety, you don't really want to know. Thread.interrupt is in boost but not in the standard. I used to think, oh, isn't that a shame? And now I think that's a really good thing because that's the right answer. And so I personally will oppose putting it in the standard. And the reason is because thread interrupt at least waits to a reasonable point before you throw an exception. In practice, that's what Java does. It's what .NET does. In practice, it's still too hard to use. We actually have data about this because people do not expect. Basically, you throw it the next time you get to a wait sleep join point. Like you wait for a mutex or a semaphore until you join with something or until you sleep. People just don't write code to be exception safe, expecting those things to throw. Even when they know, they forget. .NET supports thread interrupt, has since version 1. It's unusable. Do not use it because the .NET frameworks are not interruption safe, which means you cannot be doing anything reasonably useful and be safe. And they're never going to be. Now, having said that, the right thing to do is... So you got to do it cooperatively. Have a way for any of your work items, threads or tasks, to look for a flag that's appropriate for you, test a condition. You always, always want to write your own interruptibility, but in using the semantics and explicit variables that make sense for you, so you'll never forget because you've got to test it yourself and voluntarily participate. And this is insanely important because not only does it help you at program shutdown time where the end of main can say, okay, everybody stop now, and you still get reasonable time program interruption, but you should just be doing this all the time because it turns out that if when the user hits cancel on a GUI operation, you want to throw away the work. You just want to be always ready to interrupt. And in fact, if you look at the major operating systems, I'll take Windows as an example, in Windows Vista and again in Windows 7 and further, almost everything has been made async. wait-free and interruptible, including open file, including closed file, because Office demanded Windows do it, and customers demanded, and Windows realized the need themselves. So always plan to be able to be interruptible regardless, and as bonus, it will also help you at program shutdown time.
Well, let me make a brief addendum to this. I wasn't advocating a thread interrupt. The problem with Herb essentially says define your own protocol. Define your own shutdown protocol. It's not too difficult. It's a shared flag. At the end of the day, application is shutting down. You set that flag. Everybody pulls it. Everybody's happy. The problem is when you use multiple libraries, each is going to have its own shutdown protocol. They're not going to work together. There should have been a shutdown protocol in the standard, and I hope it's going to be. Better than thread interrupt.
So we should talk about this over a beer rather than ginger ale.
Rather than tea.
Different kinds of bubbles. But, tea, that was your mistake. But the reason, I was not advocating a single bool that everybody checks. It's got to be something that's semantically part of my operation. I'm test determination condition. Because you do this all the time anyway when you say do parallels find. You want to stop if somebody else already found a result, right? You're going to do this stuff anyway to get early termination. You also do it for responsive. Now, what about libraries? Yes, if your library it does not provide interruption yet or the ability to cancel work in a cooperative way yet, then you can't do anything about it. The best you can do is let go of the thread. You know, your hands are tied at that point. That's true. But it doesn't do you any good to have to kill the thread. That's just asking for undefined behavior. Libraries more and more will get on board and will surface cancelable APIs, and they'll all be a bit different. Here's what you say to cancel this. And it doesn't matter. They don't all have to be the same. But more and more, you'll get async and cancelable libraries, just like we have in operating systems.
Right.
The question is, your favorite feature was concepts that didn't make it. Is there anything like that? I mentioned this yesterday. There is a concept summit going on this week in California on moving concepts forward, and I'm liking the draft work that's coming out of it. So I expect to see some very interesting work on concepts coming out later this year and for the next round of standardization. However, it's good they didn't make it in. They weren't ready. But that does not mean they're a bad feature. They're a wonderful feature and the best thing that could happen to templates, but you got to make sure they're right. Template
meta program. Question is, what's going on with ConstExpr? It's touted as the new template metaprogramming technique. Who knows about ConstExpr? Right, just a few. ConstExpr is the fourth sub-language added to C++. Language number one, preprocessor. Language number two, straight C-like, and C++ 1984. Language number three, templates. Language number four, ConstExpr. Essentially, ConstExpr is a very limited subset of the language that you can actually use in interpretive mode during compilation.
Because compilation was already too fast.
Because compilation was just going so fast, it was skidding, so they thought, let's actually put the brakes there. So ConstExpr allows you to define functions and qualify them with ConstExpr such that you can actually initialize compile-time constants with interpreted C++ code, and I'm not kidding, interpreted C++ code. The not-so-good news is that there's a huge technical and non-technical debate on how big the subset should and could be, and many people simply didn't see the usefulness of this, and therefore ConstExpr functions are limited to one statement, which is return. The good news is that that return statement can actually involve an arbitrarily complex expression containing all arithmetic operators, all the question mark operator, which, as I said during lunch, was slipped in almost by mistake, and it was a good mistake. So, question mark operator, and floating point?
I don't remember.
I don't think so. So essentially, whatever you can put today in expressions that are computable during compilation, you actually can put in a context of a
function calls too.
Function calls too, and here's the important part: when you have function calls and when you have the question mark, what do you have?
Conditionals and recursion.
Recursion, and the, you know, and the ability to terminate it with a question mark, right? So once you have recursion, the ability to terminate it, all of a sudden you can write the factorial function in a way that it can be entirely evaluated during compilation against constant numbers.
Which you've always wanted to do.
We now have another way to write factorial.
We have another way to write factorial. And it's a way that's different from the if-else, because you can't use if-else. You just can't. You got to use the question mark operator. Just a second. So, I think it's a bummer that not more of the language was included. I think it's a bummer that you can't use things like floating point numbers and strings. But it's going to be very interesting to see what's going to happen in that space. In my experience, people have taken every single comma in the C++ standard. They've soaked everything they could from it. So I presume there's going to be a very high interest in the abilities of ConstExpr.
I have to say, I have not paid deep attention to ConstExpr other than being at meetings and seeing the highlights being debated and the design points talked about. But I just love your description. That's why I've started grinning when you said, and it's only a single line or single return statement you can write, but it can contain all the operators and question mark. And as soon as you said that, I thought, oh, everybody's always wanted to write APL in C++.
Right. And I think, I think it actually is supported in GCC 4.6. I'm not certain, so if you want to play with it and you have that compiler, I think you can play with it.
ConstExpr is a hint, like inline. It's not mandatory. So if you decorate something with ConstExpr and the compiler can't make it, it's just gonna switch to compile mode, not interpret mode, and it's just gonna evaluate during runtime.
So ConstExpr functions will be evaluated during compilation if the compiler can do it, and you can initialize things like enums and use it for array sizes and stuff. And if the compiler can't figure out how to do it during compilation, and it occurs in a context where you could make a normal runtime function call, it will turn into a normal runtime function call.
I remember you can use double, because one of the motivating factor of ConstExpr was that it's awkward to say std colon colon numeric limits of double colon colon max, and that's a function call. How come it's a function call? Because it's a constant. So that ConstExpr solved that issue as a typical example. Yes.
When will we see effective C++ OX?
Oh no, she said exceptional C++ OX. I heard her very clearly.
EC++,
Effectional C++, okay?
Actually, I've received the question several times. I think we probably all have. So the question is sort of, when are C++ OX books going to start coming out? So Herb, when is your book coming out?
Well, to again not answer the question, I know Bjarne is actively working on the fourth edition, which is C++ OX, and he's hoping for it to be ready next summer. So I've seen some sample chapters, so I know he's working hard on it. And the rest of us need to get up out of our chairs and tour our typewriters.
Something I've told a number of people, this is a tricky time, actually, to be an author for C++, in the sense that if you write a book now and you don't, even if it could appear instantaneously, and obviously it could not, if you don't talk about C++ OX, then you have a book that, when it goes out, is immediately out of date and becomes only more out of date as C++ OX gets larger adoption, which is not a very attractive proposition to a publisher or to an author. On the other hand, C++ in practice, and you guys are actually, I think, unusual. You know, we took a poll, and something like 60% of you are able to use certain C++ OX features in production code. But most of the people I've run into say, you know, it's interesting, we like it, but we have to run on multiple platforms, or we have backward binary compatibility issues, or whatever it happens to be. So the number or the percentage of people who are using C++ OX compilers for production code is still comparatively small. And so if you write a book that takes advantage of a lot of C++ OX stuff, then you produce a book where people might look at it and say, you know, this is really interesting, but I can't use this right now. So I'm going to wait a couple of years when better books come out and I have better compilers and stuff like that, which makes it difficult. And then, in some sense, a third option would be, well, let's suppose you've got some old dusty book floating around on the shelf because you wrote it at some point. And you say, no problem, I'll just kind of dust it off, I'll upgrade it a little bit, call it a new edition, and, you know, we'll all be good. The problem there is that, speaking only for myself, if I were to sit down and take a look at effective C++, I've looked at the item titles, and in my opinion, the vast majority of the information is still accurate. It may not be complete in the sense that I would say write copy operations, but I would now add and write move operations under certain conditions. So it's not inaccurate, it's just incomplete in some cases. But every single example in the book would have to be rewritten from scratch, because things look funny without auto these days. They just don't look the way that they normally would. And for example, to not even mention anything to do about with the threading API, it would not do justice to the kind of material. So I've thought, obviously, a lot about what it would take to produce something, either a new book or a revision of one of my existing books. And it's just a really big challenge to try to figure out what would you write, who would your target audience be, and what are you going to do as compilers start rolling out new features. But for example, right now, for a lot of people, Visual C++ is a very important compiler. It has a lot of really nice features, but it doesn't have all of C++ OX by any means, and has nothing to do with the threading API right now, which is kind of an important omission. So to try to figure out what do you write and when do you write it is just really difficult. So I quit.
There's also the issue of the more you just are documenting what's there, the safer you are, and earlier you can start, because, you know, as of today, the final ballot ended, so hopefully we know what it is, and we can start writing the documentation, the first books that people learn it from. The more prescriptive you are, the more you rely on experience that we are still gaining as a community with using C++ OX features, which are still rolling out, and which are still being adopted in large code bases. Now, some of that experience we've already got, because, yeah, we might not have shared putter, but everybody's got their own counted putter. And so a lot of things we have experience with. Const expert, not
maybe
so much.
So.
Now, just thinking about our books here, like we have thought about it, but it just as we, this is prompting me to speculate about which of our books would be written most easily and in what order and what timing. So I think of your books, and I promise to talk about mine too. Well, I'll start with mine, because I've dodged it a few times. I think Exceptional C++ and its two exceptional follow-ups, you can pretty much start, you know, within the next year or so and be mostly, because you know what the flavor of C++ is, you know what the example should add because it's omission. It's like, oh, it's correct, but oh, there's also this, or you'd write the examples differently. So that one could start fairly soon. I think effective C++ probably could in the next year, maybe two. It depends how much guidance and understanding. A lot of your items are going to stay the same, but you may want to say, you know, if you're going to talk about C++ OX, yeah, this is still the same, but there's these 10 new things that just are dying to be said that would be new items and that would be necessary, and maybe some of those we still have to learn what the right advice is. I think the last one of all our books that should be revved is C++ Coding Standards, because that one you absolutely want to be sure reflects consensus, understood, well-baked, reliable advice. I think that's the last one. The one I haven't mentioned is Effective STL. That's one I think could be written immediately, because very little has changed about Effective STL. The thing that's going to affect it most is R-value references, and most of all, lambdas. And that is the book that is going to have the biggest number of diffs, because every one of your examples is going to change in a good way to use lambdas for probably half of your examples, and you will love them. Trust me, you'll love them. I mean, they're great, they're cute, they're furry, they're, anyway, they have pink cottontails. And furthermore, but a lot of your advice about using algorithms, how long have you been telling people use algorithms instead of handwritten loops? And now we can say it with a straight face, because it's good advice, and now it's practical.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest one to rewrite would be, for me, would be Effective STL. But you still have to worry about the hash tables and integrate that whole business in there. We got to start talking about array and integrate that in there. Lambdas are an issue. You got to talk about bind. You got to talk about function. And frankly, I don't think it's reasonable to talk about that without mentioning threading in some way, too. So, I mean, a straightforward, anyway, that's, for me, that would probably be the easiest one to do, but it's still not easy. The most important one would probably be Effective C++. That seems to be the one that people turn to for advice on how to use things. If you would like to see a new edition of Effective C++ that is filled with useful information, go forth and make lots of mistakes. Tell me about them so that I can go, okay, now we know what works and what does not work. Because You know, it happened to be called Effective C++ because the actual title of my biggest 50 mistakes just didn't sound that exciting. But at the end of the day, that's what motivates the advice. You know, what works correctly, what doesn't work correctly. The reason we know is because we tried both. So
the other, I did miss one book, and it was a very important one. And
the deprogramming language?
And I think that the other book is, that you wrote is one that you have demonstrated today. You may well, if you don't mind not talking about ConstExpr, you sound ready to write again. Because modern C++ design talked about, okay, hey, look, the standard's done. It was done in 1998. His book came out in 1999. Compilers that compiled all the examples came out, I don't know how many decades later.
I don't care if it works. I can start today.
Exactly. He knows what's supposed to work. This guy has a compiler built into his brain. It is scary. So he knows the, and because you had experimental implementations, you had basically MetroWorks and GCC and VC++ yeah. and Borland, and you could, back in the day,
mix and match, yeah.
Overlay 90% or 80% of his code compiled on one of the compilers, and he could sort of overlap them and figure out what worked and actually reasonably try to debug your code, and the rest you compiled in your head, which is still scary. And you're there again right now, because right now the stuff you need, Variadix and Lambdas and Auto and many of those things, are available, starting to become available enough in overlapping compilers so you get at least one to cover 80% of your code, and the rest you can just compile in your brain. How do you do this and still have a child? You still have too many brain cells.
I don't know. So I'm considering writing a second edition. It would be a complete rewrite because so many things have become simpler, but then many many more interesting and complicated things became doable. So definitely. So what material is right now in modern C++ design would be compressed. But that would leave room for a lot of new material. I'm having a lot of thoughts about a good allocator implementation and the observer design pattern, which is absolutely huge in a lot of applications. It's absolutely huge. Not to mention threading, which I'm ashamed of the chapter on, you know, everything that's about threading in modern C++ design is a very naive view of classic threads. So that would need to be replaced. So it would be a major rewrite.
Now, having said that, and to give you credit, when you look back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and every compiler has a regression test, and they make sure that they can compile these things, and then we can ship the product. The only two community libraries, and you probably all know this, but for the record, the only two community libraries that basically every major compiler vendor added to their test suite of cannot ship unless we compile are Boost and Loki.
Yeah.
So you have done a lot to shame the industry into actually implementing the standard, and I'm confident you can do it again.
We need to do it again.
You yes. destroyed them.
All right,
you
so
destroyed them.
I got to destroy them. We're
done.
So, big mistake, asking authors about books, big mistake. It's going to talk like forever. Like, do you get into fonts and cover design?
Yeah, but we're over time, and since we said we try to respect people's possible constraints,
all right.
Why don't we just end? Let's end by talking about books. Excellent idea. So thank you very much for coming.